So let me just begin. What can physics say about life? So let me get around the brass tacks. I don't want to disappoint you, but I'm going to quote one of my heroes, Richard Feynman. It says, everything that is living can be understood in terms of the jigglings and wigglings of atoms. Now, that may be true, but this is a big jump between atoms wiggling and jiggling and real life. And to drive that point home, I'm going to quote another physicist. And this was said after he wrote a very famous equation. And after he just wrote that down, he said, the general theory of quantum mechanics is now almost complete. The underlying physical laws necessary for the mathematical theory of a large part of chemistry and the whole, a large part of physics and the whole of chemistry are thus known. The difficulty is only that the exact application of these laws leads to equations that are much too complicated to be soluble. So therein lies the problem. When you look at a complicated system, our fundamental laws of physics, quantum mechanics, can't even begin to describe something from basic fundamental laws. It becomes much too complicated much too quickly. And so keep this in mind, and I will try to return to that at the end of the lecture. So most of what we know in chemistry and biology has been determined by bulk studies, and if you could look at things happening one at a time, molecules, biological reactions happening one at a time, could you see something different? And to try to perk your imagination, suppose you were on Mars and you had a special telescope that could measure something like the average number of legs on an organism. And you happen to be looking at the zoo, San Francisco Zoo, and you find that the average is 3.7. Now, this is puzzling because on Mars, the creatures have 4 legs and 6 legs and 8 legs and 2 legs, and some have no legs, but never 3.7. Not to worry, because your theoretical physicist friend explains why it's natural to be 3.7. But if you then looked and could look at individual animals, then you'd realize a very different thing. And there is a supposition in our own brains that if we look at simple systems like individual atoms or molecules, they're all the same, they're identical, and they should behave in very similar ways. And so the average becomes really what is happening. And quite often the average has nothing to do with what is happening. So my tack on this is, again, as not a deep theoretical physicist, but as an experimentalist, I want to quote the great American philosopher of the 20th century, Yogi Berra, who said, you can see a lot by watching. And so if you have new instrumentation and new ways of looking at things, maybe you can stumble on something. Okay, what's the new way? Well, when I was at Bell Laboratories, we developed methods to manipulate atoms and also microscopic particles. And when I came to Stanford, shortly after I came to Stanford, I set about saying, well, if we can hold on to micron-sized spheres and things on the scale of an atom with laser light, why not try to hold on to individual molecules? And so I worked with an MD-PhD student who taught me a little molecular biology so I could start gluing polystyrene spheres onto DNA. I worked with other colleagues, Jim Spudich in the medical school, Bob Simmons, a biophysicist from King's College London, to do some force experiments on watching a single molecule of myosin pull on a single actin filament. And so, at least from my point of view, this said, okay, it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm going to tell you now about two things, little short stories that have come out of my lab. One is the cleavage. That cleavage is a word that means cut RNA by a particular enzyme called a hairpin ribozyme. Now, to my physicist friends, don't be too scared of these words. They are just invented to keep physicists in their place. But so I will try to explain the words to you, and I hope, and I tried to cull out most of them. But ribozyme means it's an RNA, a piece of RNA that acts as an enzyme. What's an enzyme? An enzyme is like a chemical catalyst. It makes a biological reaction occur at roughly 1 billion, 10 billion times faster than it normally would occur. So enzymes are very important. Without enzymes, biological reactions, many biological or most biological reactions, would simply not happen. And proteins are enzymes. Many proteins serve as enzymes. And in 1980, it was discovered that RNA could also serve as an enzyme. And that has made big news. And they're looking more and more important as time goes by. So I'm going to describe an RNA enzyme, and I'm going to describe something that I'm sure many of you have heard of, and that is the machine that actually makes the proteins by reading messenger RNA. All right. So this is a schematic of this simple enzyme. It's in green and blue, and these letters are the bases. So it's RNA. It's like DNA, very similar structure. There's bases and there's a backbone. And the AAUAG are simply the bases. And the enzyme itself is actually the green and blue parts. And this particular thing, it's only 50 bases long. It's a teeny little enzyme. And what it does is it attaches to another piece of RNA very specifically. So it notices there's a specific base pair sequence and attaches to this and it cuts it. And that's all it does. In fact, but that's an important process because RNA enzymes, now we know, do a lot of splicing and dicing of RNA, messenger RNA, after it's been transcribed. Now, because it actually is specific, it can identify a very specific piece of RNA, people are beginning to think maybe you can engineer an enzyme like this to recognize a particularly destructive piece of RNA that you want to get to denature in some way. And so people are thinking about designing these things to cut HIV viruses. But let me just tell you the basic idea of this. This structure of this part and this part, these are little short stubs of double helices, and this bubble over here means that the bases aren't making bona fide Watson-Crick base pairs, and so they're kind of dangling about. This thing folds into itself, and this is a cartoon of these helices folding into itself. And when it does that, there's a chemical reaction that occurs when these backbones are in close proximity, and there's a cut made here. I don't want to describe the chemistry, mostly because I don't know it that well. But just to say, this is understood when you put the backbones close together. This enzyme could either cut the backbone of the RNA, or it can join it together. It's completely reversible. If you have two pieces that are broken and bound together, it can join it. Otherwise, it can cut it. Okay. Now, this experiment was actually done in our early days when we were actually trying to do proof-of-principle experiments. And a biologist, Niels Walther from Michigan, had heard me give a talk. And he approached me and said, well, the techniques you're developing, maybe you can help with my problem. And his problem is to understand how this little enzyme cuts this piece of RNA. And so we looked at it, and I said, sure, we can measure these rates. And these are some of the questions that we were thinking we could measure. All right, so it's very simple. What we did is we're going to use a technique. It's actually an old technique invented in applied to biology in 1967, invented in the 40s by physicists. And that is, you have a dye molecule over here, and you excite it with, let's say, blue light. And normally this molecule emits in the green. But if you put this molecule next to another molecule that normally absorbs in the green but emits in the red, what you can have is what we call energy transfer. Namely, the energy of the light goes into this molecule. The energy in this molecule gets transferred to this molecule, and then you see red light if the two molecules are sufficiently close together. So by looking at the ratio of red to green light, you can find out how close these molecules are to each other at a molecular scale. And it turns out that there's a very steep fall-off. So when they're very close, you see mostly red light. When they're very far away, so their red molecule has no effect, you see mostly green light. And in this middle over here, at a distance scale of 5 nanometers, you can see some mixture of red and green. And in fact, by looking at the change in relative color between red and green, you can actually measure distances less than 10 angstroms. So this can be a spectroscopic ruler by just looking at the ratio of colors. Okay, so this is a wonderful technique, and so we thought, why not try it? It's very simple. You put a red and green molecule on this thing, and so when this enzyme is standing up straight, you excite mostly green light. You see mostly green light. When it's in this so-called dock position, you excite the green molecule, but you see mostly red light. And when the piece of the other piece of RNA falls off, this becomes very flexible, so that on average, its average distance is dictated by this stiff double helix. And so you see intermediate, red and green. The idea is very simple. We just put a lot of these molecules on a microscope slide. We come in with a laser and excite it with green light. Then we simply look with an optical microscope. There's some very simple optics that divides the image into a green image and a red image, and we just project the two images onto a very sensitive camera. So it looks very low-tech. It's just in an optical microscope, a pretty expensive camera, and the only other thing you have to worry about is that it has to be fairly clean, and you can't get rid of all the stuff that fluoresces. Okay. One other thing we added at the time that was new is that we wanted to put reagents into the molecules. And so we wanted to pin the molecules onto the surface. So once the molecules were loosely pinned to the surface, we can flow reagents across the molecules, and we can expose our molecules to different things. So in this case, what do we see? We see that this molecule is flipping back and forth. And so this is an actual raw data of the intensity of the green and red light from a single enzyme. And so what's happening is when the green is high, it's standing up straight, and when the red is high, it's folded into this position where you get a lot of energy transfer. And so you see that it's very good signals of it flopping back and forth between red high and green high. And this is real-time data and just flopping around. But you notice something. This one molecule here spends very little time in the red high state, another very short time in the red high state, and so on. This one spends some intermediate time in the red high state. This one is spending a lot of time in the docked state, the red high state. Occasionally, you see transitions between the two, but for the most part, they seem to remember what they did last. So if they spend a lot of time in the docked state, it undocks and comes back. And it turns out if you plot out, you make a graph of all the times it spends in these states, what you find is the time it takes this upright molecule to fold into one of these docked states is a constant. It's well described by a single exponential decay. No surprises here. But once it's in the docked state, there appear to be very distinct classes of times which it would take to stand up straight again. And you can see this clearly because they're different colors. But really, they were well separated and roughly an order of magnitude difference in the rate. Okay, so this was very peculiar because first, why do they have different states? Well, that was an easy thing. It turned out that as the thing came in docked, it would form a different number of hydrogen bonds, and we could show this by actually making point mutations on this molecule and defeat some of the bases, the hydrogen bonds that the bases would make. And then we would change everything, and it seemed to scale right. So I said, okay, not so surprising. It's making different hydrogen bonds. But it was remembering what it was doing. So here's one of the simplest RNA enzymes there's around, and it has a reasonably good memory. It would remember for about an hour before it would lose memory. And so this was quite a surprise. I should say that we're not completely sure what the cause of the memory is, but I'm using the word memory because it really is non-Markovian. It really remembered. If it spends a long time here, the next time it comes down, it's going to spend a long time there. And that's what we call memory. And it must be that there's some other thing flipping around in perhaps a stochastic way, but it's much slower than the time it takes to dock and undock. Okay. So I want to take some of the mystery out of it. But it was a surprise. And this is something that people did not expect to see. There's a lot of things going on in biology that seem to have some hysteresis. But I want to point out something else. Here you have one piece of RNA, and this enzyme cuts it into two pieces. All right? Now, this is a covalent bond, and so you need to supply some net energy to cut this covalent bond. And so what we found when we measured the rates of all these of this enzymatic reaction, that yes, indeed, it does take net energy. In order to cut this in half, you have to supply energy. That means the cut piece of RNA, you've got your intact RNA, you've got to go up over some hump maybe, but in the end, the equilibrium position is that you have to supply energy. But this enzyme doesn't burn any fuel to cut it. Okay? And the reason is this enzyme has gone to school and knows about statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. And it knows that it's not the energy, like the heat energy that you normally think of, but it's what's called a free energy, which is the heat energy, the enthalpic energy, minus something that has to do with S, the entropy, the amount of disorder. And so what happens is normally systems, if they're naturally going to relax, they go to states of lower energy. Balls rolling down hills. That's the natural state of affairs. You don't need to burn energy to have a ball roll down a hill. And if you're not burning energy, that means you must be going downhill in free energy. And what is happening fundamentally is that two pieces of RNA in solution have more entropy, considerably more entropy than one piece, and that increase in entropy is actually more than the net energy you need to break the hydrogen bond. So this enzyme says, I don't need to use fuel. I can break this covalent bond because you're going to gain so much in entropy, you'll be all right. All right? Now, if you pose that as a design problem to an engineer and said, I don't want to burn any energy because the free energy is higher for two pieces, how would you do it? Now let's go back and look. What is it doing? It comes and binds, this piece of RNA comes and binds, and it goes into this dock position. And what we found from our measurements is once it's in this dock position, it's twice as likely to join the two pieces than to break them. Okay? That means you need to net energy to break it. And what is it doing? If it happens to break this piece and it undocks, well, they originally were joined by 10 base pairs. When it undocks, there's one piece joined by 6, one piece joined by 4. At the thermal temperatures this thing operates at, body temperature, and the time it stays in the undocked position, those two little pieces fly off. They're not bound as well. And they just fly off. The enzymatic reaction is done. If it didn't happen and there's still one piece, it goes back and tries again. And each time there's a probability of 1/3 that they would have cut it, it goes up. So you take 2/3, raise it to the n power, and you find that you've done your reaction. So the reason it's flopping back and forth like that, in fact, the times that it takes to flop back and forth look very nice, because in a few cycles of this, it's done its thing. It hasn't burned any energy. It's done always, everything is reversible, but it's taking full advantage of this disorder, the entropy. Okay? So you look back at this little simple enzyme, and the moral here is this is pretty smart. Okay? It's, now we see why it's flopping around. And you can actually begin to understand the rates. All right? So in Bolden, we decided to do good and look at even crazier problems. And so I want to remind you of the central dogma of biology in very important calligraphy. So here we have the DNA. And this, as you all know, the base pair sequence contains all the information about your genetic makeup. And there is an enzyme that transcribes. If you want to make a particular protein, there's an enzyme that goes to this DNA and unravels a little bit of it and makes a mirror copy of one strand of the DNA called RNA. It's a wonderful enzyme called RNA polymerase. There's huge amounts of study of how this thing actually works, what tells it when to start and stop and things like that. But then this message, the messenger RNA, then goes into another machine and makes proteins. And this machine reads this message. So for every three bases, it looks around, say, UUA, some base sequence. So what's the amino acid that corresponds to UUA? Oh, there it is. Pop it in. What's the next message? There it is. Pops it in. And so it translates the base pair message into a string of amino acids. The string of amino acids fold into a protein. And these are, for the most part, the magical enzymes that make life happen. So I want to study how this machine actually works. So here's a picture, a 5-angstrom picture of this machine. So these purple things and these dark blue things are proteins. The light blue and the gray things are pieces of RNA. These red things in here are transfer RNA. this little squiggle in here is the messenger RNA. This is a 5-angstrom structure of this. Now we're going to peel back and look at this object without the RNA. And it's very nice because you see right here at the tips over here, that's the transfer RNA are holding the amino acids. So they're looking, this transfer RNA, for every amino acid, there is a unique base corresponding to that amino acid. And the toe of this RNA is playing footsie with this messenger RNA. And if there's a match here, then this enzyme says, okay, that's the right amino acid. Put that into this growing chain of amino acids. One of the things you should point out, I should point out, is there's no proteins around in the core where these amino acids are being joined. So in this sense, this enzyme is also an RNA enzyme. One of the most essential features, namely linking the amino acids together, is done by RNA. Okay, so we want to understand how this thing really works. Okay, so the overall scheme of the transfer RNAs going in and linking amino acids was developed 40 years ago. But the mechanism has remained a mystery. There have been a new genetic, biochemical, and kinetic experiments, and you'll be hearing now today about some new single molecule experiments that we have been doing. So I need to tell you a little bit of background. The RNA, the amino acids enter in what we call a ternary complex. This fancy word means three parts. What's the first part? It's the transfer RNA, and this is the thing that's going to play footsie with the messenger RNA. So these dashes here are the bases to see if it's a match. There's this blue thing here. That's a protein. That has a fancy name, elongation factor TU, and it's a catalyst. It's an enzyme, and it makes the insertion of the right amino acid occur much faster, and we'll see a little bit later how that occurs. And, of course, the most important thing, the amino acid, and that you can't see in this picture, it's behind this blue thing. All right, so what happens? This is now an atomic structure. It's a fake thing you can get actually off the web. You can get the coordinates in their programs, and you can actually make these pretty pictures. But this is the ribosome. This dashed thing is where the messenger RNA is. And here's a transfer RNA, and here's another one. And suppose you want to make a protein chain. Well, this thing comes along, and this protein over here sticks to another protein on the ribosome. And all the amino acids carrying all the ternary complexes will stick. And so it's a general sort of faintly sticky thing, and then it checks, am I the right one, by checking if the base pairs are right. And if it is right, then what happens through a sequence of steps, this thing incorporates in, and a peptide is formed. A peptide bond is formed. Two amino acids are linked together. After that, they kind of start to straddle over. Another mystery step occurs where another object, another protein, comes along and nudges it. So this is in a so-called P site, and this is in the E or exit site. And then this thing flies off, and it's reset, and it's ready to accept another one. So what happens in this process is you start this initiated, and every time a ternary complex goes in, is it the right one? If not, it rejects. If it's the right one, it says, okay, make the amino acid link, go through here. You're burning units of fuel, two units of fuel, and it goes round and round again, resets, and goes round and round until it finally gets to a message where it doesn't code for an amino acid, and it says time to stop, and there it is. So this is how you make proteins. This work was done in collaboration with Jody Puglisi in the structural biology department at Stanford. And it started with Scott Blanchard and Harold Kim, two graduate students, later joined by Ruben Gonzalez, who is a graduate student here. And Scott finally graduated and is now a postdoc in my group. Okay. So now I'm going to focus on just one question. How does it actually pick the right amino acid? Well, it does it very well. Its error rate is on 1 part in 1,000 to 1 part in 10,000. Now, if you look at this, and the way I was taught in high school biology, you say, well, it's because of the bases. If the bases are complement to each other, if it's a right match, that's a good chemical bond, and so it sticks around longer, and so it'll accept it. If it's one of the bases doesn't match, you don't have as many chemical bonds, it will fly off. So that's good. So let's examine that in some detail. There's some series of spectacular experiments that were done by Wolfgang Wintermeyer and his colleagues. And what they found, and they're basic experiments, they would put a dye molecule on the transfer RNA. And as the transfer RNA goes into the ribosome, there's a little bit of flexing of the transfer RNA. And for whatever reason that's not understood, the amount of light this dye molecule emits is changed, not by much, 5 or 10%. But if you look at a whole bunch of them, what you can find is that it goes into different states. And they look at the time dependence of how the light, the amount of light is changing. And from that and other techniques, they were able to actually build together a model for how this is really making its decision process. And that plus other experiments that others have done. And what they found was, here's our ribosome. This yellow thing is that protein. So it sticks to the ribosome, it checks, am I the right one or not? If I am the right one, it goes forward and goes into another state, signaled by a change in the amount of light. And if it's the right one, it goes forward at a rate of 500 per second. If it's the wrong one, it goes forward 10 times slower. The good news is, if it's the wrong one, there's a one base mismatch. So two of the bases match, but the first one didn't match. It rejects 100 times faster than if it's the right message. So this is perfectly what you want. This is doing the right thing. The blue guys are the wrong one. The red guys are the right ones. It's going fast. However, the next step occurred so fast that it didn't matter. If whether it's the right one or the wrong one, it was so fast compared to the rejection rates that no matter what was incorporated, his measurements told him it was happening. And the ratio was only 1.07 to 1, right to wrong. Okay. Then afterwards, he found that the only real selection was done later, much later, where he was getting a selection of about 1%. And he could measure when the peptide bond was formed. Now, to be fair, he realized that this was contrary to what was measured in E. coli by a bunch of orders of magnitude. But he said, well, we know something. I had to do my experiments at high concentration of magnesium, and we know that if we put E. coli in high concentrations of magnesium, they make many more mistakes. An order of magnitude more when you go by only a factor two in magnesium concentration. And he was up by that factor of two, so he said, well, at least an order of magnitude was due to that, and maybe that's why we didn't see the first selection. Okay, so we decided we wanted to play, and so here's our ribosome, here's our transfer RNA with our little green dye on the elbow, and we put in another transfer RNA with a little red dye on the elbow of the RNA. So the amino acid is up here at the tip of my finger, the feet that's going to check the bases are down here by my thumb, and the dye is right there in my knuckle. And if this thing incorporates into this machine, you're going to see some color. So let me show you the raw data to give you an appreciation. So here are these spots. Each spot, for the most part, besides some dirt, is a single dye molecule attached onto the tRNA on a ribosome. So one dot of light is one ribosome on our surface. And in this field of view, this is seen through a green filter, and this field of view is seen through a red filter. The same field of view, but the red filter. And so we start the clock, and we start throwing in transfer RNA with the red dye, and this fuzz around here is the dye weakly being excited by our green laser. But occasionally you see what's happening. There's beginning to appear more and more of these spots of light. And when these spots of light, this one would correspond to this one over here, you find that the ratio of the colors, red and green, are changing. Okay. So what we did is we flowed in some transfer RNA. Here's our message on our messenger RNA. When we flowed in some transfer RNA that was the right match, it was absolutely the right thing, and we wanted to compare that to a near match where we kept the same transfer RNA, but we changed the message. So instead of the first one being a U, it's a C. And so you would make two things over here, and this one you would only make, it's a weak one. So this one has two bonds plus a weak, what's called a wobble pair, so it's effectively like one. This is effectively 2, 4, 6, 6 hydrogen bonds, and this is 2 plus 1, 3, 4. Okay, it's a little different, but not much. But the difference is spectacular. This is a single time trace looking now at the rate, plotted on the y-axis is the ratio of red light to total light. And here's one pops in, and you immediately begin to see more and more. Here it's all green light. Here it begins to see more and more red light. It might pause a little bit here. It goes up into this state, wobbling around. And we showed in other experiments that once it's up here, it's actually formed the peptide bond. I don't want to tell you that detail. This thing here is a technical flaw in our experiment. One of the molecules, it's a single molecule, and they sometimes blink off. They go to sleep for a little while, and they pop back up. And we don't know why it is. We'd wish it go away. But what we're going to focus on here in the first few hundred milliseconds. And so this type of stuff is okay. So this is when we put in the right tRNA with the right message. This is one where we put in the same tRNA but the wrong message, and we see a blip, blip, blip. These are separate events because, remember, there's this, all this transfer RNA flowing around solution. If we wash that out, these blips go away. So we think each blip is a, let's play footsie, check, nope, you're not the one I should be dating, you're out. Okay? Now you put hundreds of these onto a time scale, and what you see is, here's you float in the thing, so the baseline changes. And then this scattered thing here is, you know, these little blips. But if you put in the right thing, it looks pretty good. But this is the absolute wrong way you want to analyze the data. Because what you want to do is, for each time trace, once it passes a certain threshold, you say, let's start the clock then. You don't want to start the clock when you threw in the solution. You want to do that when you're working with a billion molecules all at once, but we're working with one at a time. So the point here is that because you have the time record of each individual molecule, you can synchronize at any point you want. And when you do that, you get this pretty picture. So once you're above threshold, for the one base mismatch, you see that most of them just dump immediately. Some of them straggle up a little higher. For the correct tRNA, you see that instead of dumping, they go maybe into some other state. Don't know on this one. And then it goes up in this high state, which we showed in earlier experiments that, yes, we've actually formed that peptide bond. And this stuff here is an onset of this blinking that we wish would go away. So we're going to now explore what's happening here and compare it to what's happening here. So for the first thing you can do, oh, just looking at this raw data, you say, yes, this is selecting something. And in the first stage of selection, we found that it's, in fact, there was some selection in this first stage. It's about 7-1. We were at slightly higher magnesium concentration than Wolfgang Wintermeyer, a factor of 2 even higher. The reason why we see selection they don't, we believe, is because their probe confused two different states with a single state. And then what they do is they do a mass rate equation fit to that. And so they were, since their probe didn't actually see two different states, they missed it, so they were doing the best they could. And so but it's really two states. And in fact, this is crucial for interpreting really what's going on. Okay, now let's look in more detail at what's going on. We can put in the right transfer RNA into the ribosome with an antibiotic called tetracycline. Now, you all know about antibiotics. In fact, many of you have had tetracycline. It turns out there are over 200 antibiotics that are used to kill E. coli and other bacteria, mostly other bacteria. You don't really want to kill your E. coli, but other bacteria, and they attack the ribosome. These 200 antibiotics attack the machine because it's such a vital part of the life of a bacteria. If you make this machine not work, the bacteria die. What does tetracycline do? Well, we found out what it does is it stops the advance of this transfer RNA into the ribosome at the very first step. And at this point, even if it's the right message, they dump. Okay? Whether it's the near miss or the hit, it dumps. And so that first step is really a bona fide state. Okay? Well, there's also another part of this thing when the transfer RNA comes in. There's a unit of fuel in this. You're going to break a phosphate bond. In biology, the coin of the realm in terms of energy is phosphate bonds. You break a phosphate bond, you release some chemical energy, you use that to do something. And in the accommodation process, you're breaking a phosphate bond. So what we can do is we can put in the transfer RNA, the turning complex, but with a pre-burned unit of fuel. Instead of GTP with 3 phosphates, triphosphate, we're going to put in GDP, diphosphate, NP, and so the bond is already broken, but but by and large, it looks essentially the same. Very different. It goes from that initial 0.35 state, and it stalls here at 0.5. Okay, so you haven't gotten to the point where you burned anything yet, and you see that this thing was a bona fide state, this 0.5 state. The 0.5 is half of it red, half of it green. And once it's in this 0.5 state, it lingers there for a very long period of time. In fact, about a factor of 30 longer than before. So what's the mechanism for selection? Now, you need to know some facts, some structural facts. And so this came out, there was a hint of it in 1999 by Joey Puglisi, NMR work, but it came out in glorious detail in 2001 with Ramakrishnan. And what he did is he looked at the atomic structure of the bottom part of the ribosome that's accepting the tRNA, and he looked at that structure, and he found the structure of the bottom part with the tRNA in it. And what he found was that this thing closed in around the base of the tRNA. So in addition to having a base pair match, this thing reacted by closing in a little tighter and gripped it a little bit. So there were additional chemical contacts. Okay. Another thing, which you just saw in our data, once it's, if it's a right message, and once it goes into this other state, before it's burned a unit of fuel, it's now stable. It's going to linger around for a long period of time. So the selection process must be over. Okay, so we, and one other fact, another structural fact that came out 2002, was after it's stabilized, it turns out it's the transfer RNA is being held at the bottom where the bases are, and it's being held up here with another loop on the ribosome, and there's a chemical contact of one loop of RNA on the ribosome to this thing, this protein. So there's a little loop called the sarcin-ricin loop that's now thrown itself on this little protein and it's made a chemical contact. So this thing is bound here and bound here. And it's bound there after GTP hydrolysis. Okay. So now we're going to make a little leap. It's not much of a leap. This thing comes in and it plays footsie. And because it's playing footsie, if it's the right match, we know from structural data that it closes in. Well, if it's going to close in, what do we see? We see that when it goes from 0.35 to 0.5, it's actually moving closer into where it should be. That's from our FRET data. And so it's actually rotating, remember, our dye molecule is on this elbow, and it's rotating this dye molecule closer to another dye molecule located about here. Okay? So it goes from this point to this point, just based on the fact that the bottom part has now wrapped itself around the bottom, and we know from our FRET data it's rotating closer. Now, it actually doesn't smash it up against this loop of RNA, this sarcin-ricin loop, immediately. Why? How do we know this? Because it takes 50 milliseconds to complete this reaction. Okay? So it's held there. It's a little closer, but it still needs a big thermal fluctuation to attach. Now, as a physicist, you look at this and say, that makes great sense. Because what it's done is the minuscule or no chemical reaction difference here is amplified by the reaction of the bottom part. So you make additional contacts if the shape is right. But it does something even better than that. It's going to magnify that a little more because if the shape is right, it torques it. But it torques it not all the way because it still needs a gigantic thermal fluctuation to link it, 50 milliseconds worth of gigantic fluctuation. That makes it highly improbable. That puts the probability up in the exponent. So if it's not the right shape, it doesn't quite torque it enough. So you've now had a compounding of probabilities all put in the exponent. And so this, is, we believe, is the first stage of selection. And it also very clearly seems to suggest what was before a very big mystery to this. This molecule, the ribosome, is big. It's 200 angstroms in size. The transfer RNA is 90 angstroms in length. So so the biologists said, how could this be? You know, something's happening down here at the foot, and then you're making an additional contact, and we know GTP hydrolysis is occurring here some 60 angstroms away. How is this knowledge communicated up here? Is it some mysterious way through the body of the ribosome, or is it through the transfer RNA? And we now know that from our FRET measurement that it's just rotating closer together, that it's just simply getting it more likely to touch the sarcin-ricin loop. So that's what we call an or what the biologists call an allosteric reaction. It seems to be an action at a distance. So what's the real mechanism? Well, what happens after GTP hydrolysis? Well, what we know, again from structure, is this after GTP hydrolysis, which is, by the way, occurring right here on this, right at that point, this protein falls away. Now, we don't know, but it's likely that if that protein falls away, this contact is greatly weakened, and maybe it snaps back into that rotated position. That's if it's the right fit. If it's the wrong fit, it actually rotates even further away. And so what appears to be happening is that after GTP hydrolysis and this thing is released, Hopfield was dead on right. You're testing the bottom reaction again. Okay? He was invoking GTP hydrolysis, remember, to make it irreversible. And he suggested maybe you test it once on the way in. After GTP hydrolysis, you test it again. If it works, then you fully accommodate. But it's – so we think he's right. He was being tested again. It's mostly shape, though. It wasn't energy, bond energy. But there's something even better. And the last thing, again, a structural piece of information from the atomic resolution data. When the tRNA is really in there, it's about to make the peptide bond form, it's bound here at the base. It's also bound right near the amino acid, right just before that, and a little loop, another loop of RNA on the ribosome called the A loop. And by looking at the atomic resolution of the upper part of the ribosome, remember, you can't get atomic resolution of the whole thing, but the atomic resolution of the upper part, you find that when tRNA is bound to it, this A loop is sticking out and making contacts with this tRNA. So it's changing shape in order to make contact. So you might think, well, isn't that cozy? Before this tRNA can actually go in fully, something's got to happen over here. It's got to change shape to allow final binding to stabilize the tRNA. Otherwise, it's held down here. So you might think, is the energy released in GTP hydrolysis, you have some energy you can burn. Maybe you can make some mechanical motion to change that A loop. So we looked at the following. We took our ribosome. There's a chemical you can use that actually cuts that sarsen-ricin loop at a very specific spot. And so we expose this reagent to our ribosomes. And now the sarsen-ricin loop is cut. We throw in the right tRNA. It goes from the initial state up to the 0.5, but it never makes it to 0.75. And you see this little haze up here, which I'm not sure shows up, but you see futile attempts of it going in. It stays momentarily, but it backs out, goes in and backs out. And so with the sarsen-ricin loop cut, what we're seeing is the door isn't fully open. It can't really finally stabilize in the right thing. And if you compare this to the intact one, it goes 0.35, 0.5, 0.75 peptide bond forms. So we're conjecturing, and this is wild speculation, and that's why it's suitably colored in brown, that brown is the color of speculation, that maybe the energy of hydrolysis is actually used to supply the conformational change for the A-loop that finally opens the door and lets it go in. So here we have a really cute little setup now. We have first it goes, it checks, am I the right one or am I the wrong one? If it's the right one, fine, it goes in. You have GTP hydrolysis. That makes this step, series of steps, different from that one. But this is now a series of steps, where each step is now magnifying the probability of picking the right one. And once you've passed it through here, you can still get the wrong people in. And so after GTP hydrolysis, it breaks the link of the tRNA to the sarsen-ricin loop. So you're testing it again. But in the meantime, you're finally opening the door to let the tRNA go in for real, permanently. Before that, the door was only ajar. And that we see from our FRET data. So this is the second test. It's now hanging over here, but can finally stabilize over here. It couldn't even go in here before, or it can fly away. So you get to test it again. And the overall fidelity rate at this magnesium concentration is a little bit better, 6 times 10 minus 3. But remember, we're at 15 millimolar concentration, a factor of 3 higher than what is in E. coli. We will try to repeat these experiments at lower concentration. There are technical reasons, but we have a faster camera. We think we can get closer to physiological solutions. But it seems to all be there. Okay. So what have you heard about? There are two steps, selection and proofreading. It starts with the bond formation, but it's mostly shape. But it's not only shape, it's shape magnified by the reaction of the bottom part of the ribosome that then induces this to move to make it another probability of linking right to the correct thing. Now you see all those steps are not only necessary, they're minimal. You needed GTP hydrolysis to separate selection from proofreading, but you're seeing that GTP hydrolysis and getting it stable is setting the step for the next step simultaneously. The hydrolysis was needed to make the two separate, but it's also finally opening the door so it can finally go in. So it's beginning to look like a minimal number of steps, very efficient. Okay, so at this level, I'm hoping I'm convincing you that it's beginning to look like chemistry and biology. Biology is beginning to look like chemistry and physics. It's becoming to look very mechanistic, okay, because we have these beautiful high-resolution structural pictures and a little bit of motion picture, and we've been linked these things together. So let me come back to what's going on. Can physics be described by life? Or can life be described by physics? Yes, some graduate students think there's no life. And what is physics really like? We like universal laws that apply to all biological organisms. And you haven't heard about any universal laws. Let's talk about what we mean by universal law. I would call Kepler's laws, let's say the planets go around the sun in ellipses, as a phenomenological law. It just, you know, that happens to be they go around in ellipses, they sweep out equal areas and equal times. But a universal law is, let's say, Newton's law of motion and gravity, because they apply to all bodies, to planets, to galaxies, to apples falling down. And that's more a universal law, and you can calculate all sorts of stuff. So we would ideally like to have a Newton's law. We don't have Kepler's laws yet either. Okay, now, here's some common sense things. By burning energy, you can do rapid proofreading, and you can also transport molecules better in diffusion that way. And so this you could have guessed, but we don't understand these things. If you really think you understand it, you could say, at what point does a biological organism choose to burn energy to transport a set of molecules from one position to another versus letting diffusion take its course? Proofreading mechanisms. Here's one that's determined by shape, not by the strength of chemical bonds. And it's the shape discrimination amplified by these conformational changes that occur. Well, it turns out that probably a lot of proofmaking mechanisms are by shape. These are some molecular structures of another enzyme that can't make mistakes. This one duplicates DNA. So here you have your family jewels, and you want to make a copy of it. And so you unwind it, and then on each separate strand, you want to put in the complementary bases so you have an intact piece of DNA that you can pass down to your children. And DNA polymerase is the name of this machine that makes this. They come in all shapes and sizes, but they have roughly the same structure. And it's a curious little thing, because this thing has got something that looks like a hand, a thumb, a finger, and something. And here's the DNA. And here it's in a mode where it's looking at the open base, and it reaches in solution, puts in the right one, and then marches again, puts in the right one. So it's replicating. But it's actually pretty smart, because it sometimes says, wrong one, put in there, and it actually flips into another mode and says, you're not really supposed to be there, out you go, and try it again. So what's it doing? Well, it's probably looking at the shape. So put it in, touch it, you know, is this, good fit, going to the next one. And so this is perfect for Fred. You can put a little thing here, a little thing here. Is it really touching or something? So we'll have a look at this guy. But looking at the structures of other things, RNA polymerase, it's looking like, it was funny, I was in a seminar by a graduate student. He was giving this thing about what he's found of the structure of RNA polymerase. And he was saying, "And here's the structure, and here's the DNA, and it seems to be all okay, but there's nothing in this machine that's looking at whether the bases are doing the right thing. It, too, has to make a decision to put the right base in." And it always seems to care about the outside. And someone in the audience said, no, that doesn't make any intuitive sense. There's got to be something it's checking. And I was sitting there chuckling and saying, no, it looks like it's pretty good. You know, it's the shape. So maybe it's the shape. Who knows? Okay. So I want to end by saying that physics is very young. It's actually only 400 years old. I would say people like Galileo were the first to really combine experiments and mathematical models and really test what's going on. And so let's talk about 400 years, and let's put it on a time scale that we can understand. This is something I took from a Rich Mueller website. It's actually the temperature of the Earth looking back 12,000 years. Here's the temperature of the Earth as measured by, let's say, the ratio of oxygen-16 to oxygen-18. And the warm parts over here were good things, you know, building of cathedrals and things like that. The bad parts down here were bad things like black plague and things like that. But could have been a coincidence. And then over here, there's a little burp, and then finally it could plunge down. This was an ice age. And over here is global warming. I don't want to be facetious. I actually believe there is global warming. I'll be glad to take questions on that. I just want to say that you notice it's very stable over here. If you look back a half a million years, it's wobbling up and down. It's going from ice age to warm spots, ice age to warm spots. But over here, you have a very stable part of the history. It's really the big stable part. And right here is when agriculture started. Maybe also coincidental that agriculture starts when the climate stabilizes. That's where science is. Okay. And this is where maybe civilization starts. You have agriculture, you can have enough free time to think about other things. So it's a very young, and a lot's happened in the last 400 years. In fact, a lot's happened in the last 50 years. And so you can say, well, what will happen in the next 40 years? Well, I'm not going to live that long, and people are interested in what's going to happen in the next granting period, next 3 or 4 years. But I think you should keep that in mind. I think there's some clue as to, first, the elegance of some of these biological machines. I just described two, but how really elegant they are. Now, and despite the fact that you have this huge memory of evolution that may not get you, you know, but you also have billions of years of time to refine your mistakes. Now, it's also true that maybe not everything is the absolute best. It can be optimized, just as the structure of a city is determined by its history and not by some design engineer with a blank piece of paper. But in some instances, I think like the ribosome, at least in this accommodation process, it's looking pretty elegant. Now, you can ask even bolder, crazier questions, like why is the transfer RNA so big? The amino acid is a little thing that's like tip of my fingernail, and there's this big thing that's bringing it in. Is it because of history, biological evolution, or is there something about the time scale of the dynamics that you want it big to make it slow? Because if you want it, because you need decision-making time to reject or accept, and if it's small and rattling about very rapidly, then it might be too hard to design something that's, you know, 10 e-folds away. It may be easier to design something that's 3 or 4 e-folds away, but bigger and just slower to move, so the attempt frequency is slower. Who knows? That's wild speculation, doubly brown. Why not? We can think about it. And so in the end, I think, yes, it's wigglings and jinglings of atoms. But as we have these new probes to look at things at this molecular point of view in real time, I think I'm very hopeful that we can actually reduce this stuff to something that really makes sense. There's no mystery step anymore, at least at simple things like how do we make proteins? Or how do we decide what proteins to make and transcription factors? Whether we can understand more complicated things like how brains work is a different story. I mean, there's another project we have in our lab where we're trying to understand how neurons talk to other neurons. But the detailed molecular thing of how they really talk at this mechanistic level. And from there, if you can then make things that so you can bring this, it's admittedly a big jump from understanding, you know, the C word, consciousness and things like that. But maybe memory is not so bad. That, I think, is within our realm of our understanding. But we'll see. So just wait 40 or 400 years, and I'll report back to you if I can. Thank you.